professor in the philosophy, I'm faculty advisor for the philosophy club. So the host body for this talk is the ISU philosophy club. And we're happy enough to have our faculty involved here with us today. And I'll let Arnold give you a brief description of his background and what he's going to talk about.
Well, I've always been interested in the big questions, even before I went to college. And the big questions is my interpretation of philosophy. It's possible that I'll talk about what philosophy is supposed to be at the very end of this talk. But in any case, that's my interpretation of what philosophy is. I was briefly a philosophy major in college, but for better or worse, I turned out to be an economist. And I've been at this institution for too long. 30 odd years. Does everybody have a paper, by the way? Paper? And although I turned to economics, I was still interested in the big questions and trying to frame an overall picture of these questions, which made sense to me. And I have been making slow progress over the years, but I would say that my progress has not been steady. It's been very, very slow for a long period of time, and it's been accelerating recently. In other words, if I can draw a graph. Progress. Not like that, but more like that. So there's hope that if this acceleration continues, I can actually complete the system while I'm still alive. Let's see, is that enough of an introduction? I'll say my favorite philosopher is David Hume, just to kind of place what I am. Okay, now, what I want to do here is, this is really an entire system of philosophy, and certainly more than I can cover in an hour, so I can give you just really an overall vision of what I'm trying to do. And my aim is to make these assertions at least plausible to you. That is, here's an alternative view which one can at least entertain without dismissing it, without further inquiry. The particular question here is, are there such things as objective values? And I suppose the first question is, what would one mean by objective values? I can think of two possible interpretations here. And in fact, I'll entertain both of them as possible meanings of this term. The first one is, it may be, contrary to appearances, that everybody actually has the same values. And they're all expressing it in terms of their own particular situation in the world and their perspective on how things are. The second thing, possible interpretation, is that there's something in the structure of the world that, so to speak, promotes these objective values. I'm thinking of something like Adam Smith's Invisible Hand, a term I'll be using several times in the course of this lecture. Okay, now, not only do I assert that there are objective values, but I'm specifying which those objective values are. And I believe they are represented by the greatest happiness principle, otherwise known as utilitarianism. So the first thing I'll do is try to define this concept in a more or less reasonable way. Because there are actually many interpretations of this, and I'm taking one of them as the correct one. Utilitarianism, or the greatest happiness principle, says that we should maximize the overall net happiness expected of the universe. Now, what does that mean? Net refers to the balance of pleasure over pain. That is, somehow or other, you have to aggregate pleasures of all entities that have pleasures, subtract those that have pains. That gives you the net. The universe refers to the fact that everybody and every entity transcendent in any sense is to be included in this, no matter where, when, or in what form they exist. And expected is to be interpreted in the sense of probability theory. That is to say, we don't know for sure what our actions will be. This action might be good, this might be bad. What we have to do is to take the probability distribution of the alternative outcomes, take the weighted average according to these probabilities of the alternatives, take a look at alternative actions, and choose the largest and do that one. Well, that seems like a very complicated thing to have to do. And one of the things I want to tackle is, does it make any sense to say that people actually do this or can do this? Now, there are a number of problems with this. I mean, in some sense or other, this is a nice goal, so to speak. That is, people who are utilitarians who might be considered benevolent in some generalized sense. And the question is, if everybody is utilitarian in this sense, why is there so much cruelty, pain, bloodshed, et cetera, waste, inefficiency, all these other things that sort of characterize the real world? So that's also something that we have to think about. The first thing I want to talk about in detail is the concept of uncertainty and probability. And in ethical theory, there's actually been an amazing lack of concern with this particular issue. And it's especially acute for the greatest happiness principle, because after all, that is future-oriented. It's a so-called consequentialist type of ethic, which you have to consider the consequences. And the further you go into the future, the more uncertain things become. Therefore, uncertainty is really one of the keys that have to be considered. The proper way of dealing with uncertainty is the theory of probability, and I just want to say just a very few words about probability, just those concepts which are relevant to what I'll be saying from here on in. Okay, a probability can be interpreted in two different ways, so-called subjective or objective, and one of the statements I'll be making is that, in fact, there's no real distinction between these two. There's just one concept of probability. You might have, in some cases, a subjective goal, in other cases, an objective goal. One key concept is that of a random variable. And my interpretation of it is the following, which may not coincide with that in probability textbooks. A random variable can be thought of as a question, which has a set of possible answers to that question. For example, is it going to rain tomorrow? Answer, yes, no. Or what is the population of Afghanistan? Answer, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, up to several tens of millions. One of those sentences is stating a true proposition. All the others are stating false propositions. We don't know which in general. And what we do is give weights to these things. We distribute a total credence of one, you can say, among these things, representing the degree of credence that we give to each one. So you can say, here's P1 is the probability that I assign to this, P2 I assign to that one, and so forth, in such a way that these things all add up to one. These are non-negative numbers. Probabilities change over time as evidence accumulates. You can write time over here. I pick out a particular statement or sentence, let's say S1. Here's the probability that I assign to it at this particular time. As time rolls by, evidence accumulates and my probabilities can fluctuate like so. And it's possible that they'll end up at 0 or they'll end up at 1. There are the basic rules that apply are really quite simple. It says that if I have a certain probability distribution and I observe evidence P, then I modify the probabilities. Let's say P of S1 is the original probability. That gets modified to the probability P prime S1, which is simply P of S1 conditioned upon, I don't have the time to explain the concept of condition, but you can take it in an intuitive sense. In other words, if E is true, you're going to change your credence in various ways, and that's the basic rule of involved here. And I'll just mention one consequence is if this ever goes down to zero, it stays at zero from now. If it ever goes up to one, it stays at one from now. In other words, the bottom and top part are like flypaper. Once you're there, you stick there by the rules of probabilistic inference. Furthermore, the following is true. Suppose that, unbeknownst to us, that S1 is true. Then, it will be the case that this particular probability distribution will tend to 1. Intuitively, what's going on is that if S is true, it will tend to produce evidence which is favorable to itself. I mean, all of this can be expressed within probability theory itself, but the moral of the story is, if people are following this particular system of inference, then truth will out in the long run. Or at least there's a tendency for that to happen. There's no certainty that that will happen, but in general, there will be that tendency. Furthermore, random variables come in hierarchies. That turns out to be important, and the concept of hierarchy is going to be very important in the remainder of this talk. Let me illustrate one classic example of what you might call a probability model that I would consider a one-step hierarchy. Suppose you're tossing a coin, and suppose that, each particular time you toss the coin, that corresponds to a certain random variable which has a positive value, you can't pick. Now, so we have a series of tosses. Each one of these represents a random variable, the first toss, second toss, third toss, and so forth and so on. Governing these tosses is a variable that attaches not to the individual tosses themselves, but to the coin. You can think of maybe theta represents the propensity of that particular coin to fall heads. So you can write the probability that x1 equals head given theta. So in some sense or other, there's a variable that attaches to the coin itself. And as I said, there's a one-step hierarchy because we have the coin tosses and then the coin itself. But there's no reason why you have to stop there. In the real world, you can think of not as a single coin, but of a whole group of coins. Suppose that the nth coin has a certain parameter theta n. This represents that propensity of that particular coin. You could have theta 1, theta 2, theta 3 representing different coins. And you could have a random variable governing these thetas. In other words, talking about coins in general. And you could have still higher and higher level random variables. The basic idea is this. You can think of the real world as being organized in a hierarchy of parts and wholes. So here's a particular entity. It's divided up into parts. This itself may constitute, with other entities, parts of a still higher whole. These might constitute still higher ones. So that, let's say, we talked about tosses of a coin, coins themselves, bundles of coins, collections of physical objects, and so forth and so on. You can talk about the cells, making up the tissues of a body, making up the organs, making up individuals, making up groups, making up nations, and so forth and so on. So you've got all kinds of different hierarchies in the world. And you can think of these hierarchical random variables as attaching in that respect. Random variables which attach to wholes are higher in the overall hierarchy than random variables attaching to parts. And what we have is a probability distribution of all of these together. Typically, probabilities at this level are referred to as objective probabilities, and probabilities at this level are referred to as subjective. But that term itself becomes rather dubious when you think of a multi-level hierarchy, because the theta n itself can be duplicated. And in what sense is that more subjective than what's going on here? So I just mentioned that the concept of probability does, in my estimation, refers both to the level of credence that you give, and also to what you might call physical propensities or tendencies or entities to move into one or another successor state as time unfolds. Okay, let's see. Well, all this seems to be rather difficult, and now we have to talk about the limitations of human cognition. We go from this rather abstract view, which in some sense or other is supposed to characterize an ideal reasoner, to the actual way that human beings behave. Does anybody behave this way? Well, yes and no. That depends on exactly how elaborate you're talking about. First of all, since people have a limited cognitive capacity, the richness of the collection of questions that are relevant to you is going to be strictly limited. So in other words, you can think of two people, for example, one of whom is an expert in a certain area, and the other of whom is a complete amateur. The expert is going to have a very detailed collection of random variables referring to this particular area. The amateur will have just a few coarse random variables referring to it. The second way of simplification is that what you might call, we exaggerate the degree of certainty to which we're entitled to. I mean, probability distributions themselves are complicated things, and if in order to simplify things, one often says, well, let's just assume that S1 is true. I'll give that a probability of 1. And I'll give the others a probability of 0. In fact, I'll forget about all the others. I'll just go through life assuming that S1 is true. That's still another way of simplifying things. Well, the third way would be to focus your attention on some things and just forget about or suppress other aspects of interests are narrow. And this varies from one person to another. I mentioned the degree of expertise. It varies by our emotional state. If you are in a contemplative mood, you consider a greater variety of possibilities. If you're in a mood to perform a certain action, you consider a more narrowly focused range of possibilities. You're in a state of panic, your overall mental state might focus its attention on just one particular random variable. How do I get out of here, for example? So that this represents an aspect of people that you might call, or sometimes just call, the multiple self. Okay, now, let me consider the hypothesis that are actually utilitarians, or they're actually trying to maximize the greatest happiness principle. I'll give three immediate objections to this, if you haven't thought of them already. The first is the problem of evil. How do you explain the fact that there are evil doers? And the example I give in my little handout here is Hitler, Stalin, and Osama bin Laden. Well, for one thing, they have a different world outlook than most of us. Given a certain set of assumptions about how the world is structured, you could say this particular kind of behavior is justified. In terms of, now suppose I'm a utilitarian, but I believe in fact that the West is corrupt, and I believe that God is on my side, and I believe that the proper thing to do is to spread my particular version of Islam over the entire world by any means possible. You've got Islam. So, I mean, one way of doing this, by making sufficiently outre assumptions, you can say, you can justify just about any kind of action under these particular assumptions. Now, I should say that what has happened since these people have acted indicates that, in fact, these assumptions are very likely false in these cases. So that one possible definition of evil from this point of view is somebody who acts from conviction, but acts from the point of view of a false view of the world, and therefore does things which are very harmful, hopeful to the world. When the gods were destroyed, they first made man. Okay, the second problem is the problem of selfishness. Greatest happiness principle is impersonal in the sense that all sentient beings are supposed to be treated at the same level, but at least it doesn't seem that that is the way that people actually operate. And to put this in some kind of context, let me bring in the concept of social distance. Here's yourself. Here's your circle of immediate family. Here's your friends. Here's your co-ethnics, maybe. Here's your fellow religionists. Here's your national group. Here's all human beings, et cetera, et cetera. You go further and further out. The further out you go, in general, it would seem, the less concerned you are. Most concerned with your own welfare in some sense, then highly concerned, but not quite as much with your immediate family, then your friends, your neighborhood, and so forth and so on. Is this compatible with the idea of universal benevolence? Well, yes and no. Say it's compatible in the following sense. First of all, there are a lot of things that we have to do for ourselves. In the paper I say everyone has to brush his own teeth. So in that sense, a lot of the activities that we do are self-service. Secondly, the degree, since you're close to the individuals who are at a close social distance, you know a lot about them. You know most about yourself, perhaps. A little bit less about members of your immediate family and so forth and so on. That means that in general you can act in a more intelligent way concerning people who are close to you because you simply know more about their own their situation, their needs, what needs to be done, and so forth and so on. So you can try justifying things from that point of view. However, there is still another thing that has to be considered, and that is the fact that we all tend to see the world from a certain perspective and think of the world in a sense as if it revolves around us. Just take a few historical examples. The idea of geocentrism, for example, in the history of science. People were convinced Copernicus, I suppose, that the Earth was the center of the universe. And you know, the leading scientists of the day who considered the possibility that this was not so finally came to the conclusion that indeed the Earth was the center of the universe. And this kind of perspective is really quite general. It's hard, or at least it requires a certain mental effort to say, okay, this is how I see the world. But if somebody was standing over there, they would see the world from this other perspective. And here's how to translate to this other perspective. It's quite difficult to do that. And the general results are that I'll just give both examples. Geocentrism. Anthropomorphism. We tend to see the world in ways that resemble us. You see something moving in the forest, your first impulse is to say, there's another person out there, or there's some intelligent agent out there who may or may not be hostile. advance of science has been, to a large extent, the retreat of anthropomorphism, that is substituting non-anthropomorphic explanations for these things. I mean, you can see that. So in other words, what I'm saying is this: that this anthropomorphism is really just another case of this particular idea of thinking of the world as revolving around oneself. And the factual assumption, I mean, you can represent this in terms of probabilities or distributions or worldviews. This factual assumption tends to move into a value assumption, because if the world is revolving around you, in some sense or other, that tends to go along with the notion that you are very important, maybe more important than you should be in the overall scheme of things. Let me just raise one question. Are there elements of this perspectivism that still exists today? Well, let me suggest one possibility. Cosmocentrism. That's the idea that the known universe represents everything that exists. That's simply an extension of geocentrism. The things we know about are what exists. The things you don't know about tend to be what you consider to be non-existent. To give another quote, I can be bounded in a nutshell, but consider myself king of infinite space. If you have a pond and a frog in it, the frog might consider that particular pond to be all that there exists. We live in a known universe, admittedly a very big one, maybe 10 billion light years across or something of that, that particular form. But are we making the same kind of narrow assumption about the nature of the universe as the frog is making? I'll just mention one or two consequences that might occur from a narrow kind of cosmocentrism. The Big Bang started everything that exists, as you find in, let's say, books by Hawking, statements of that sort. Are there universal laws? Well, of course there are universal laws, or are there? Well, there are laws that seem to apply to the entire known universe. But if the entire known universe is just a little speck about it, all there is to be known, then take it in under one. Law of gravitation. Let's say the sun attracts the earth because the earth obeys Kepler's laws. The earth attracts the moon because the moon obeys the same laws. The moon attracts the earth because of the tides, and so forth and so on. So you've got a pretty good notion of laws that apply at least within the solar system. Binary stars, galaxies, and so on. And luckily, one could say, these laws continue to apply. As far as one knows, the law of gravity applies to the entire universe. But it's only the known universe. What is the probability that it applies beyond that particular point? So I'll just leave that question open. Let me just mention that what I talked about here, social distance, also applies to time. Here's myself, here now. My future selves are at a certain social distance, and the further in the future they go, the greater the social distance. Future generations are at even greater social distance. And the general kind of fall off of knowledge and concern that applies over space, in this respect, also applies to time. Economists refer to that as time discount. Still another problem is dissension, the problem of dissension. If the greatest happiness principle is universal, why aren't we all conscious utilitarians? Which we obviously are not. The analogy I give in this paper is that things have to become right before they are actually coming into existence. Intelligence is obviously a very useful trait as far as survival is concerned, but it took billions of years before intelligent creatures came into existence. For utilitarianism to become general, you'd have to have a clear understanding of probability, which does not occur now. You'd have to have a clear understanding of happiness, which is even more shape in terms of the principles, and so forth and so on. So I would say the time is not yet right. But if I have to make a prediction out of all of this, I would say that there will be a gradual growth and spread of these particular ideas. Okay, now, how does all this work out in the social world? Well, that's a big problem, and what I do is discuss it under six headings. And I will briefly talk about that. Capital theories first. The greatest happiness principle is something that refers to time. You have to add up over the future. And that means it's a problem of dynamic optimization. And dynamical problems of that particular sort, the mathematics of them is such that you get what are called shadow prices, which guide action in a way I can't describe in detail. I'll just say that the price system that arises in an ideal free market economy tends to duplicate these particular pricing predictions. The concept of capital refers to, let's say, an entity which gives off a stream of services over time, maybe a piece of land or a machine which provides services, and the value of this stream of services is divided in the value of the entity itself. Economists have generalized this concept to human beings themselves, the idea of human capital, and in fact, you can think of households as themselves little factories which produce human capital. Let me also mention an alternative value system at this point, that's virtue values. Refers to the accumulation of what might be called virtuous habits, truth-telling, magnanimity, and so forth and so on, and which accumulate by practice. The point I want to make here is that this concept of virtue is really a special case of the human capital concept, because you're accumulating virtue. And therefore, virtue ethics is actually not a competitor of utilitarianism, but a corollary of it. And if the set of virtues is adequately defined, Aristotle himself made a list of the virtues, but he famously omitted benevolence as one of the virtues. Let me turn to competition. Competition I'll distinguish two types: competition among ideas and competition for resources. You can think of let's go back to a random variable, S1, S2, set of statements, one and only one of which is true. In some sense or other, these statements are in competition for each other. As far as our credence is concerned, there's a total credence of one which has to be distributed among these propositions, you remember, P1, P2, et cetera, adding up to one. Competition here is that process that I talked about, where probabilities change and shift over time with evidence. You can think of more or less successful competition, and there will be a tendency, as I said before, for the true proposition to win out in the long run in this competition. What you have to do, however, is, there's a problem of correcting for biases. Maybe I should say just one quick thing in order to explain that. Suppose you're a jury. Here's time. Probability of guilt of a particular defendant. Okay? Suppose you saw it up over here. And you hear the evidence, and the evidence goes wrong, and finally you decide maybe. There's a problem of evaluating the sources. Most of the information that we get is through testimony. That is, other people telling us something or writing something, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's a problem of evaluating this particular testimony. For example, typically, let's say the prosecution presents a case up here, and then the defense presents a case up here. Now, you might think at first glance that begin hearing the evidence, and therefore your conviction of guilt rises and rises and rises, and then the defense comes along, and you have mitigating circumstances and so forth and so on, and falls and falls and falls. That is not necessarily the case. Because, you know, the prosecution will tend to select those facts which are indicative of guilt. And, plus, a certain perception involves, suppose that the prosecution these facts, and you say, well, these facts are less damning than I thought they were. In that case, it's likely that it will go down while the prosecutor is doing his case. In other words, here's somebody, what I've done is I've corrected for the bias that I expect to occur in this particular presentation. And given that, I find that the prosecution really has not presented the evidence, which is very strong, and therefore, my belief in the guilt of this particular party is actually gone down. And of course, the opposite of the perfect defense is actually weaker than you expect it to be. It might go up again. So, correcting for bias is quite important when it comes to getting testimony. Think of somebody living in a dictatorship in which paper that you read, the only paper that's available to you, is one that always supports the government. Well, obviously, you have to read it with a very jaundiced eye in order to figure out what's actually going on. What is called the scientific method, insofar as it exists at all, I believe is a set of programs that, in effect, try to knock out bias as much as they possibly can. Now, competition itself has the following advantages. Oh, there's one thing I should have mentioned. That is, it goes along with the idea of what's probability gets to one if it sticks there. If it gets very close to one, there's a tendency for it to stay close to one also. Suppose that there's a certain, let's say there's a certain range of ideologies, and you happen to believe that one is almost certainly correct. In that case, you will tend to not bother reading reputations of it. It's a waste of time. I mean, if you know that something is almost certain to be true, why bother reading the opposition? They're probably going to be just full of fallacious arguments anyway, or facts which aren't facts at all, and so forth and so on. So there's a tendency to do that. When you find contrary evidence, there's a tendency to reinterpret in such a way that it is not contrary. That leads to what might be called cognitive traps. You have this kind of situation where, for some reason or other, you believe that this ideology is almost certainly true, and for the reasons that I've mentioned, you tend to stay in that position. We really should put this in some kind of social context, because typically there will be a group of like-minded people who listen mainly to each other, and reinforce their beliefs over here. One of the virtues of free speech is that, in effect, it tends to get you out of cognitive traps, at least if you're even partially willing to do so. You're confronted, in, perhaps in a very brash manner, with somebody who has just the opposite opinion, and if it's presented in a forceful and reasoned manner, it's possible that you may begin to waver in your beliefs. So that one of the advantages of free speech and the free clash of ideas is precisely to get you out of these cognitive traps and to consider seriously other alternative possibilities. I believe also that science itself is one of the essential ingredients for the success of science competition. We don't often think about science in that way. But it seems to me that the fact that you've got different schools of thought, and you always have different schools, who are constantly criticizing each other and trying to undermine the foundations of their rivals, is itself an essential ingredient in pushing forward the advance of science by keeping each of these groups on their toes, making themselves aware of weaknesses in their own position, and so forth. Okay, now, competition can degenerate into actual conflict, and it works best when you've got some kind of control. So, competition for wealth in the free market is governed by a system of rules, let's say the laws of property and contract, and so forth and so on. Political competition in democracies is governed by a system of checks and balances among the various branches of government, and also competition of the various political parties against each other. Okay, next let me turn to the subject of externalities and institutions. Now, this is a technical economic term, but I think it deserves to be widely known. Suppose I have two agents, A and B. Think of a case where A is isolated from B in the sense that nothing that A does in this particular realm has any effect on B. Here's an agent X in the realm A. To maximize overall happiness for X is the same as maximizing overall happiness in the A realm. In other words, if there's no effect here to here, as far as actions are concerned, this particular entity over here might not exist. On the other hand, suppose that there are effects, but X isn't aware of them for one reason or another. In that case, you have what is called an externality. That would be the case where the actions of somebody in this particular realm hinges on the interests of somebody in this particular realm, but in general, there's no easy way of communicating this particular fact. Classic example, the smoky chimneys. Okay, here's your factory. You have the option of, let's say, two different technologies, one of which produces more smoke than another. B is the surrounding neighborhood, and the people in B would prefer the less smoky option, but in general, there's no easy way to communicate economically because of the scattering of people in the neighborhood and so forth and so on. So that under these conditions, the action of the factory owner will tend to be suboptimal because they will not take account of the full force of what they're doing. They will not take account of the fact that there is a social benefit from the less smoking technology, which, however, does not accrue to them, so they typically tend to ignore it. That's our egocentric predicament turning up in this particular realm. Okay, under these conditions, that tend to be institutions arising which, in effect, communicate in the opposite direction, communicate these concerns. It could be something as simple as a meeting and, let's say, some kind of contractual arrangement where one party pays the other a sum in order to influence conduct. That's a solution associated with already codes. Or the price system itself, in some sense or other, can be thought of as representing this. Exactly. Access to particular actions. Let's say go without bread or let's say X the grocer and B is a potential customer. B would like the grocer to hand over a loaf of bread rather than not hand over. And in general, there is a way of getting that particular behavior induced, namely paying the asking price for that particular loaf of bread. That's already an already established institution, so that in this sense, externalities are neutralized by the ordinary operation of the market. But over and above this, we have all kinds of other institutions which tend to neutralize these things. The legal system. I mentioned four different branches of law which do this. Contracts, and the law of contracts, in effect, says the following. Suppose you have a complicated agreement between A and B, in which is time extended in some sense. Let's say A does something which B likes, and then later on B has to do something which A likes in return. The law steps in at this particular point when A has preferred, has done his action, and B would like to get out of doing that particular action. It says, no, you've got to fulfill this particular contract. That, in other words, in effect, what the law is doing is underpinning the performance. It could be that we were robots or machines, and just a quote from myself, we could be passionlessly observing that we have no passions. But as it turns out, we do. So, and furthermore, I mean, not only do you have these entities that are similar to you, which you irresistibly ascribe the same feelings to, but the fact that we are evolved on, are related in some sense or other to the rest of nature, raises the question, how far does this extend? Is mind just a minor thought that occurs just on, just occasionally on a minor planet and is nowhere else found in the universe, or is it perhaps deep running? And if it's deep running, how come we don't notice it? Okay, the other type of principle that's involved, I think, are the nature of laws of physics. Here I'm talking about the variational principles of physics. And it turns out that the basic structure of physical laws are such that it is as if they are maximizing something or minimizing something. That's the so-called variational approach, which took about a century to set up, starting with Hope Twee, maybe around 1740, and going through Euler and Lagrange, Galilei, and culminating in Hamilton around a century later. And these particular features of physical laws are precisely the ones that have come through the relativity revolution and the quantum revolution on scale. It's still the fundamental way. Like the first thing you do with a physical system, you set up the so-called Hamilton. So, again, why is this? It doesn't prove anything, but it certainly is very suggestive that it should be this way. It doesn't have to be this way. Newton and Leibniz, even though they were, they certainly believed that the world is optimal in some sense or other, did not have this kind of conception. So, I'll just leave the question open. If natural world is not optimizing something, why does it always have this particular thing? Okay, let me just make a quick suggestion. This is really going to be speculative. I'll try to summarize it in just a few minutes. If mind is so pervasive, why don't we see it? And my suggestion is that it refers to rates of living. Take different organisms, they live at different rates. Hummingbirds live at a very, very high cells in very low metabolism, waste is in almost no metabolism at all. Plants are generally considered to be unconscious, although it's not quite clear why one makes that judgment. But they might also be considered to be creatures who are living at a very, very low level of activity. Like the example I give is the Ents in Lord of the Rings, the second volume. So, the suggestion is that we might not recognize another line or life form that's living at a pace which is very, very different from ours. Suppose there was something the size of an atom that had a mind. Well, atoms typically operate at a scale of about a femtosecond, 10 to the minus 15 seconds. So that reaction time would be about this level. It would make it impossible for us to communicate, to recognize that there is some kind of intelligence absolute. So that would be my tentative explanation of why we do not recognize these things. You just got to estimate the probabilities and see what happens. Okay, let me talk. Well, I don't know. Anybody have any original questions? Any questions?
Did you want to start fielding questions?
Yeah, well, I'd love to field questions all the way through.
Probably a good idea.
Okay. I wanted to say a few words about religion, but
I'm having difficulty abstracting anything profound here. It strikes me as obscure. It seems like a not quite arbitrary collection or mosaic of radical assertions. Many of them are plausible, but they're plausible to me on other experience. My own background in statistics or probability and things like science, you know. I'm not seeing the connection here. And this isn't all pointing to some great conclusion for me. I'm just perhaps I can't distinguish between the profound and the obscure.
The whole idea is to integrate values in some kind of objective way.
Do you feel that objective means that it's independent of humankind, independent of life? For example, do you feel that the concept of mind may have existed or did exist prior to the emergence of life in the universe?
You're defining life in the usual sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's plausible. So if you don't, let's put it this way. It's the kind of question which either yes or no is going to be a profound question. The question of whether there's more life in the universe.
Well, again, what is objective? It seems to me objective means independent of human or anthrocentrism. And it seems to me to project a mind onto the universe is a bit anthrocentric.
Oh, well, I'm not projecting it onto the universe.
That's about all pervasive.
Yeah. But what I'm saying is that it's, the technical term would be panpsychism. I'm not saying that there's one overall mind that's governing the
case.
See any strong evidence for that. But what I'm saying is that, consider the following. Suppose that we take standard scientific conservatives. In that case, for some reason or other, the whole universe is lifeless. At one point or other, life pops into existence, and not only life, but mind, pleasure, pain. Just this one little piece of the universe.
Well, they're emergent.
Yeah. Now, that's it's possible, but the alternative is that it was always there in a way we didn't see, and we're just able to recognize it in certain forms that resemble us. We recognize a life that is in effect lived at the rate that we live before us, and that resembles us in some ways. Okay, you say, I think that other people have the same kind of feelings like I do, and apes have the same kind of feelings like I do. Dogs and cats have the same kind of feelings. You begin to go down the line, where do you draw the line? The kind of question that Peter Singer is, are crustaceans. Crustaceans are fine.
Well, I mean, that's a funny question. I mean, no matter where you stop, this very odd phenomenon has occurred, and it's a phenomenon which to us is scientific. Ultimately, the only thing that gives value to this universe is essentially feelings of happiness or unhappiness, joy and agony. I mean, I haven't really defended the greatest happiness principle.
Well, that was subjective.
Yeah, it was subjective. But now we're talking about the nature itself. I mean, where these things either pop mysteriously into existence or they were there in some form. It's a matter of potentiality. Suppose this is what we know, and this is everything else. If we have no knowledge whatsoever about what's out here, it's irrelevant to our actions because we don't know how this would affect us. I mean, in principle, what we should do is put some kind of probability distribution over the alternatives so we can maximize that. But in general, you can say that we're in our little egocentric predicament that I focused on in terms of social distance. And it slowly broadens. Peter Singer has a book called The Widening Circle, which represents the kind of phenomenon of the book. We gradually become aware of wider and wider circles by the spread of literacy, by coming in contact with other cultures and so forth and so on. And then they become matters of concern. But we don't know about the rest of the universe outside the solar system. And there's no way we can say that what we're doing is good or bad for that, so we ignore it. Yeah?
I would take issue with your assertion that the social world tends to improve the greatest happiness. I do that because you see how in the natural world, individuals would act upon and fall to the things that provide them with pleasure, they do those things, but sooner than a social world, someone's an inversion of that, that the survival of caregiving decisions is to not act upon those type of impulses, to not have a nice dinner every night, or to buy nice clothes that make you happy, but it's willing to deprive oneself of those things. So that living in a social world actually tends to decrease the amount of overall happiness for those that survive.
Yeah, but you remember, how do you measure the overall happiness? There's a time element involved over here. If you could get people to be less indulgent, let's say consume fewer luxuries, and save more, you might actually increase overall happiness in the long run. It's something like going to the dentist. You're suffering in the short run, but for greater happiness in the long run. So there are institutions that arise that tend to make us, in effect, go to the dentist. I mean, look at all the ads on television about not doing drugs, not smoking, and so forth and so on. Every one of these is depriving us of the pleasure. But, at least the theory goes, it's increasing our overall happiness. Yes?
Are there any facts that the media comes to know that would warrant
Well, I haven't said anything about how I derived that principle. I'm inclined to believe that it's basically a priori for the following reason. In fact, I believe that's true of ethics generally. An ethical principle says, in effect, you're at this particular juncture, of choice among several alternatives, to this one. What you're doing is, in effect, picking out, here's four possible worlds. What you're doing is picking out one possible world actually in this case. An ethical principle cuts across possible worlds and therefore cannot be associated with any particular. In other words, by the nature of ethics, ethics is saying that this possible world is better than that possible world and so forth. It's getting to a preference order, right? It cannot be associated with any particular possible world. That's the sense in which I think that ethical things are up to. And indeed, I mean, what's underlying all of this is really kind of axiomatic approach, which I haven't talked about. Probability, by the way, is the same thing, too. Because here's probability is governing the alternative ways in which something can change. Let's see. Probability of this and that. Each one of these is defining a different world. So probability is also a study of us. And for that same reason, the basic idea of, in other words, whether that you should use the probability calculus to represent uncertainty is itself an a priori principle.
I was thinking your principle to apply things like the psychological thesis that people's behavior is actually governed by the principle of trying to maximize expectations.
Yeah, well, I'm still hedging on that. I think you could defend that at least to some extent, but I'm hedging on that because of the limited capacity of the human mind. I think a lot of this is taken over by the growth of institutions, for example, which in effect push us in the right direction. The invisible hand, the second type of explanation. You've got Adam Smith's conception, these people are basically selfish, but they are pushed by institutions, so as to benefit society as a whole. That was the part of the intervention. So both of these things are operating to some extent.
So the point is something like, as time goes on, net happiness tends to increase security. And whether or not it's individual agents that are causes.
Yeah.
Sometimes there are larger scale structures that bring it about that
this is the outcome. I'm a little hesitant to say that this supply of happiness increases. That would be true if certain other things are constant. I mean, suppose that an asteroid is headed toward us, or the sun is going to become an overbreak. Obviously, happiness doesn't increase. Say, given some kind of stationary environment, then under those conditions, there might be total tendency for more happiness. Yes?
I'd like to
Ask
a question about just put in a caveat about Adam Smith, if I may. Adam Smith did not say that the world behaves as though it were led by an invisible hand. He said it was led by an invisible hand. And he meant God. You'll find the phrase used two or three times in this Theory of Moral Science. So now I'm just persuaded that he meant exactly what he said.
Yeah, well, I mean,
it's not a matter of institutions leading. I'm just adding, as I say, a footnote to what you said about Adam Smith.
Yeah, well, you may well be right. I mean, my impression is that Adam Smith got more agnostic as he got older.
Well, he's not agnostic in the world of nations.
Okay.
So he's teleological?
Well, I don't know that you'd call it teleological exactly.
It's being led by the hand of God.
To an end that is not of their own devising. Yeah, the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker worked for themselves. They were led by an invisible hand. But he didn't say as though by an invisible hand. Because I've argued this before.
Well, that's interesting to me because I have labored under the misapprehension that it was as though, and So you're telling me that he really was a teleological, that his theory of economics is teleological. God led.
In that sense, yeah. But we're straying from it. I didn't mean to take it.
Okay. Do you hold the answer to your question here? Are there objective values? Are there?
I think there are. In fact, I specified.
The objective value is to maximize the greatest happiness. And that did that exist before there was life in the universe?
Well, then we come to the question that you raised before. You know, in what sense was it one? I mean, it's conceivable that that we were an accident, so to speak. Natural laws just had a favorable contour from our point of view, and then it takes over. I'm inclined to a deeper ontological interpretation. But, I mean, what you can do is simply say, let's set up a random variable.
Okay, well, what's your position? What's your position? Are you teleological? Do you think there's a mind there and that these things were latent until they emerged in the physical world?
I think the word a mind strikes. Misunderstanding.
Okay, a mentality?
What I'm trying to say. What I'm saying, well, let me put it this way. Here's the human brain, okay? The human brain experiences pleasure and pain. Known fact. What about the components of the human brain? The various tissues that make it up. Do they experience pleasure and pain?
I don't know.
Or is this just something that appears at the top level?
It might be a synergistic effect.
Distinguish. I mean, we can talk about emergence. There's emergence in the sense of a light bulb lighting up. That occurs over time. There's no problem there. Let's say you wake up from deep sleep. Okay. But this is a different kind of emergence. This is one that refers to higher orbital levels. Here, the highest level, the one that we're immediately in contact with, experiences pleasure. Direct observation or direct perception. You don't have direct information about the various tissues of the brain. Now, if you grant me that, in fact, the following principle, that if a whole experiences an affect, the parts themselves must experience an affect, or at least some of the parts must experience an affect, then you will grant me everything that I
want. So it's reductionism? You're saying that the component parts have to have these properties, otherwise they could not emerge.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that something like pleasure and pain is quite different from, let's say, the emergence of gravitational effects. If you have several particles, you have particles traveling in conic sections, you got two of them, so forth and so on. This seems to be quite different. I mean, it seems rather odd to say that brain as a whole experiences pleasure, but on the other hand, we don't not observe it, and the reason reason we don't observe something could be that we're not in a position to observe it because it's happening so fast. It's happening at the femtosecond second. However, I mean, I would like some physicists to get interested enough in this type of question to try to find some kind of effect that would differentiate what this occurs or not. This is completely off the radar screen as far as physics is concerned. I would like to see physicists becoming sufficiently aware of this to begin ridiculing it. That would be the first step. After they begin ridiculing it for a while, maybe they'll come up with some kind of experiment that would actually demonstrate. I mean, you do have this...
They would have to find a departure from vectors expected of this.
Well, I'm not quite sure what they...
Well, because if they don't find any incident, they don't find any deviation from what you would expect with a small group of force gravity and then they would certainly be hoping to get inside.
Well, maybe, but there are all kinds of things that we don't know. I mean, there are supposed to be something like 19 arbitrary parameters in the micro here. So, I'll try to explain that.
Can I just say, I'm sorry, I apologize for having to run off.
Yeah, I understand.
And I'm an engagement. But I can leave it to the discretion of the audience, you guys to decide when enough is enough or when to keep going. Okay?
Okay.
So, thank you very much.
Well,